Book.
No, it's the Snapchat post. Type of thing.
Yeah, Snapchat.
Snapchat.
I mean, you've been doing a good job. You seem really into doing an intro. You seem like...
I don't know if I got it in you.
Hello. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Hi, everybody. Welcome to Conference Tree. You can tell this is the morning and not the afternoon or the evening because we have no booze. And the caffeine isn't working yet. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Context Free. This is Jason M.
This is Jason K.
And thanks for everybody for coming back and listening to our meandering conversations about interesting stuff. So so we played our game, finally.
Well, we were gone.
Well, I mean, I'm not blaming
you. I feel pretty proud that I got it right back on track as soon as I got back.
Oh, so yeah. You had a bunch of people together.
And super excited that... Everyone could make it,
mm-hmm.
which is good. Yeah, we didn't have to do any, no Skyping or video. That wouldn't be the same.
It's not the same, but you gotta make the effort when people can
right.
be there.
So I will, we can get into some details. I will just say that I thought it was, I was thrilled. I thought it was a fantastic success. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, I know. I think everybody had fun.
I think everyone had a good time.
Which I think,
for a whole bunch of people who are not like, role-playing experts or tons of experience and aren't actors and or whatever, like who we're not a bunch of flamboyant like look at me sorts of people. Do you know what I mean? Who are like, oh, I'm gonna go and do this character or whatever.
Yeah,
I thought that everyone did a great job of getting into the spirit of it.
I think the word is introvert. I think that's the word that you're looking for.
Right
Yeah, so the game is
Tales from the Loop,
right?
Which you mentioned before.
Yeah,
it's Simon Stahlberg.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know the artist's name.
Is that how you say that? Because he's got a little.
I have no idea how you.
he's gonna write you a letter.
I'm just gonna say his name.
You
is
butchered
Simon
my
Stahlberg.
Name.
Right. He's the game is based off of the an art book that he put out. His illustrations are set in the 80s, and it's sort of an alternate technology. So. The thing is, everyday life is kind of the same for people, you know, bikes and cars and trucks and schools and all that sort of thing. But there's a lot of technology due to, I think, the magnetrine drive or something. There's basically a magnetic field that they've discovered about how to make hovercraft go around the Earth. To do locomotive transport.
Yeah.
You know, and it only works in the Northern Hemisphere where it has the lift. The Southern Hemisphere, it has drag, and it pulls it down.
Oh, no.
Right.
Poor Australia.
Yeah. So, but anyway, the game is originally set in Sweden, but the book provides a way to have it set in Boulder City, Nevada, which is in, like, the southeast corner of Nevada, the, like, pointy part there down by Hoover Dam.
Mm.
And the players... so we're setting it in 1987. The players are between the age of 10 and 15. I think all of the characters that we made are between 11 and 14. So last night we got together and we're starting from scratch, really. We'd all kind of like had some conversations about who people wanted to be. I'm running the game. We have six players, which is pretty cool. So six kids. And it's a little different than other role-playing stuff I've done, which is more hack and slashy, or, you know, you have a dungeon master who's running everyone through and it's like about loot and killing monsters and that sort of thing. This is more of kind of a little bit more of scene type storytelling, which I don't have a lot of experience in, and I don't know how much everyone else does, so we're all kind of just learning as we go.
Yeah, but it's fun, and I think it's less intimidating in certain ways to people that haven't done role playing before
because of the setting.
Because of the setting and because there's not like 50 books to read through to learn
right.
your various skills and the
right.
armor class
exactly
numbers and when to use your double plus whatever
yeah.
tilt-a-watt bomb of
yeah you can explain the mechanic rules in a minute
Yeah, well, there's not much there, right? Like, you have some skills, and you occasionally roll against the skills, but mostly you're meandering around doing things. So,
right.
Which is one of the things I think people talk about role playing, but it doesn't always coalesce, right? It tends to be a little like, okay, you know, this Thrycreen is attacking you. What roll initiative or something, right? Like, you're at least in my RPG experience tends to be a little more grindy. And churning through your dungeons, right? Like,
right.
More technical, which I think, I don't know if technical is the word, but is less...
Grindy is a good way to put it.
Yeah, less exciting, I think, to people who aren't into it.
Mm-hmm.
And less kind of harder to engage, just because there's so many, you know, fighting over stats and win X supplies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of takes that dynamic out of it. So I think it's an interesting intro to that. And I think for... Because I got the impression that about half the people aren't role playing people at all,
right?
So I thought that was nice that it was a comfortable intro to that sort of world without being too intimidating or just like, you know, there almost feels like a snobbishness, right? To knowing the technical details of some of these things, right? Or there can be,
right? Where one player can become the leader because they're going to know the best numerical tactics instead of like just
right.
having an idea.
They're not playing a game. They're navigating a mathematical problem space.
Right. And so I tried, you know, the game de-emphasizes it, and I tried to de-emphasize it even more.
Right.
Just because I know the group that we have, like I said, is not like, oh, this is the 15th role-playing game we've played together. And,
right.
You know, and so I have no idea where everybody's coming from. Like, I really only had an idea on a couple people, right? I wasn't sure. Like, there was a part of me that was wondering, like, this could just be a fantastic flop and everyone could be staring at me and this could be a horrible idea.
What do I do next, man?
What do I do next? But I thought that the fact that, like I said right up front, you know, we have seven adults here. I'm pretty sure between seven people, we can all move the story forward in some way. Like, basically what I told myself is this does not have to rely on you. So
right.
Let everyone else lift the thing too.
Yeah.
And I think that's why that works. Whereas I feel like in if you're running a D&D game, you feel probably more obligated to do more of the lifting because of all the numbers and the rules and all of that stuff.
And there's a map a lot of the time, right?
Like, well, actually, I don't run with a... If when I run that type of game, I don't do a map anymore because of that reason.
Yeah, because people get off the map and then you wasted a lot of time just building the map. And
I don't do the map is because everybody focuses on the map and not on each other.
Right.
They're all sitting there wondering, like, where should I move my little guy on my next turn, right? and they're just focused on that, and their introvert nature kind of takes over of, like, I'm going to control myself and we're not really a team.
Right.
So that's why I don't do the map.
So I thought when, I mean, four of us were playing the Pandemic Legacy, right? And
yep.
And I think there was a certain amount of navigating that problem space that, like, well, you
solving
can do this.
Puzzle.
And yeah. So that's much more puzzle-centric.
Or
right?
I should say figuring out the optimal solution for the puzzle.
Right.
Which this is not about figuring out the optimal solution.
Right.
Right.
Right,
that's the big difference.
Yeah, and I think the upside of Pandemic is the rule space is a lot smaller than some of those like AD&D like numerical kind of games. So,
yeah,
I'm just trying to work through the contrast of why like one is fun in a certain different way. You know what I mean? So,
right. I mean, I know you thought Pandemic Legacy was a lot of fun.
Yeah, but part of the fun there was that kind of navigation of
mm-hmm.
oh, what can we do? Like, you do this and I do that and everything else, and the board was kind of secondary in a lot of ways. I don't know. I thought it was pretty successful. I thought it was pretty successful, and everyone seemed to have a good time.
What just getting into some of the specifics of our story, so of some of the characters anyway.
Right.
Right. So we had the game provides for some different archetypes. So we had
right.
going around from my left to right at the table as I think about it, we had a popular girl.
Mm-hmm.
We had Maddie the popular girl. We
mm-hmm.
had Simon the weirdo, who we're still trying to figure out exactly who Simon
is. He's so weird that
we're not quite sure who Simon is.
He's a iconoclastic.
Right. We had Girsht Patel, mm-hmm. The younger computer geek.
Yeah.
We had Lita the cheese metal rocker.
Cheese metal, yeah, hair metal.
She's probably a little more troubled than any of the other ones. We had Keith, who lives on the farm, and he's a grade older, and he's kind of the place where the story begins is the kids gather there on a Saturday night for a evening
party barn
of Boone's Farm and Butter. And
a little bit of a non sequitur there, but
yeah. And then we had Tommy, the troublemaker, who's Maddie's twin brother, and he's a bit of the nexus of some of the kids.
But he also makes a lot of trouble,
right?
Kind of just trouble all over everything,
right? Yeah. So it's summer break, and they're having some bird trouble.
Yeah, some challenges.
challenges with the birds. And I don't know, what do you have was there a particular vignette or segment or something that you thought was like, you're like, oh, that was kind of,
I thought the initial kind of narratives of getting everybody together and overcoming these kind of random challenges that we essentially made up were kind of entertaining.
For instance,
getting Girsht out of his house. His parents wouldn't let him go.
He's 11.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, party on Saturday night with the older kids, you know, and his defined problems, because you have all these things you come up with, right? You have a motivation. It's not called a motivation.
You have a drive.
You have a drive. You have a problem.
You have a problem.
And his problem was the strict parents. And so
right.
It was, immediately came into play. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like in D&D where you just have a door that no one can open. You're just, oh, I wish we had a thief. And poor guy was stuck in his house and his parents were mad. He's trying to go out on Saturday night.
Yeah. My favorite moment was... the fact that so every character also has an iconic item, like their thing that they are really good at.
Oh yeah.
And
oh, I know where you're going.
Well, no, I thought it was great that Tommy has a bomber jacket. And I'm thinking to myself, when Tommy chose the bomber jacket as his item, I'm like, how in the world is he going to use that in an effective way? And he managed to, mm-hmm. I thought that was my favorite.
Yeah.
That was my favorite bit of the night, of like being able to use a bomber jacket in a way that mattered.
Was both funny
and
mattered.
And effect, yeah.
And created a certain level of despair.
Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of the high point there. I thought that was great. We played for like 3 hours or something, and you know, we have six characters. We had to start from scratch. So just getting all the characters together, figuring out the relationships to one another, that was a lot of fun. Everyone participated really well with that, which is cool. As someone running a game, as like a GM, right, one of your goals in any type of a game, I think, is to always give each character a moment to shine and succeed.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little difficult just in terms of the time. I didn't feel like I had the opportunity to do that for every character.
Right.
So that's something I'll certainly work in throughout the... We also didn't finish the mystery.
Right.
So I definitely try to work that in so that each character has like their moment of looking back on that and being like, oh, that's when I was able to, you know, step forward and
move things along.
And move things forward because of me. Like, it was, you know, so just... I mean, that was just really just a matter of the number of challenges and the amount of time that we had to work six in was tough. So try to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think everybody seemed to have a good time and at least got a feel for how to play the game.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How many scenarios are there? Do you remember?
That like come in the book?
Yeah.
So the book has four.
Uh-huh.
Right. One for each season of the year, pretty much. Right.
Yeah.
But it also provides. It has a whole chapter of an alternate way to play called the mystery landscape,
mm-hmm.
they call it, and it's more sandbox
mm-hmm.
style, where you kind of just keep that going with the town and those characters, you know, until they become 16, then they're no longer kids anymore,
right?
To have the places, you know, kind of keep the NPCs, the various characters in the town, going, I mean, I think it would not be that hard because the rules are so much lighter. The you would really just need to effectively write a mystery story, kind of know the truth of the mystery, and then figure out, like, okay, what are the book provides a framework for how to build things in terms of, like, the mystery, locations, the showdown, the countdown, like,
right,
these things of how you construct the plot.
Yeah.
And it provides that to the GM in a way that I don't think you have to be a genius. You just have to have kind of an idea, and you can put these things together in that milieu.
So they give you a framework.
They give you a framework to kind of come up with stuff. And then kind of having four scenarios in there lets you see four different ways that they use the framework to come up with different things. So an example of that is, like, are the locations where you gather clues, are they linear? Or are they, like, you could go to anyone? Or how dangerous is the countdown? You know, what's some different showdowns, right? So, you know, count. I mean, you know what I mean by those? Like, showdown is like the boss fight, quote unquote, right? The Scooby-Doo, it's the, you know, and then there's the denouement of the unmasking of, you know, the you meddling kids moment. So, yeah, and then we didn't work a lot of the technology or any of that stuff, but yeah, it was really good. Look forward to doing it again and just getting some of the characters that got less drawn, like, more drawn.
Right. So the artist has another book out. I think he has another Kickstarter right now, which looks a little different. So we might.
Yeah. What was the theme on that?
It's like a boy and a robot that running away or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're in every single panel that I saw, and it's an art book. I don't think it's the game.
Is it narrative? Because his first book is not narrative, right?
It looks narrative. It looks like a kind of a sequence of panels. Okay. I didn't drive too much. I just looked at the pictures and was like, yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. But it looks kind of nice. I like his style, and it feels very like Omni magazine from the 80s or something. So
I hadn't thought of Omni in a while.
You sent me an actual AR kit video from someone on the tubes of someone playing Tetris. Didn't you send that to me?
I did. And I'm going to need you to educate me more on some of the things, because what I'm finding...
Really? Okay.
Well, not on the... I mean, no.
YouTube is a place you can watch videos, and it's a sequence of...
No. So Apple announced AR kit. I think some of the... You know, I don't know what Microsoft or Android have in terms of their SDKs, platforms for making augmented reality toys, games, apps, etc. So there's actually, you know, there's a little Twitter account they started following. I don't remember what it's called, but it's, you know, basically just collecting things that people are making with ARKit, you know, to show that off. But I think I need to educate myself. I'm missing out on, you know, what are the cool parts of this versus just the lame parts, where it's like, look, I'm doing this, and instead of it being on like a black or white opaque background, I'm doing it on my living room.
Right.
Like,
isn't that fun? I mean, everyone puts, you know, like, spaceships on their cat's head, right? Like, it feels very, you know, not Instagram, but it feels like Twitter, Facebook.
No, it's the Snapchat post. Type of thing.
Yeah, Snapchat.
Snapchat,
post.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's so what are the things that are beyond, like, look, there's a rainbow coming out of my eyes? I mean, what?
Yeah.
It feels very much like a fidget spinner, right? It's just like it's just a distracting toy. I'm struggling to see some of the, like.
I mean, millions of people are still playing Pokemon Go, right? Like, that's still a thing, right? So, and that's an AR-ish sort of system, right? So,
right.
So that's an example of reasonable success. I mean, I don't think. We're not catching Pokemon every day.
But isn't that more, maybe I'm not understanding the term, isn't that more about just overlaying a game on top of the map where you are, as opposed to, like, you know, it's not like, or at least when Pokemon Go, when my son was playing it, like, whenever it launched, was that last year, whatever that was, it wasn't like, I don't recall that you would, like, hold up your phone and, you know, see Squirtle bopping around on your lawn, right? It wasn't like...
Yeah. I'm sure you would. I mean, you would see him once you found him, right? And so there was, you know, kind of a Google Maps-y integration where you would go
find
where Squirtle is, and then you would try to catch him, and then you would see him jumping up and down on your lawn, right? Okay. Like that was a feature of the game that you could turn off because it actually made the game harder.
Okay, maybe that's what we did. Maybe we turned that off. So I was like, I don't really get it.
Yeah, I mean, I have screenshots of kind of random Pokemon, you know, sitting on my cat's head or something. Yeah, so that was an aspect of it, and it just what you couldn't do, and probably isn't a good idea to do, was use that to navigate, right? Like so you could hold the phone up in front of your face, but you'd be looking at kind of a Google Maps sort of thing, mm-hmm. and you'd be kind of
like a street view type.
Like a street, well, no, like a top down map, okay. right? And you'd be looking at where the Squirtle is, and then once you found the Squirtle, it would shift into an AR view, as opposed to like holding your phone up and looking through it like a portal to be able to see Squirtles everywhere, mm-hmm. right? Or Blastoise or whatever.
Yeah.
Choose your Pokemon. So I the potential is really, really there for that particular problem, like the social gaming in the real world space. I mean, what I had brought up that I thought would be interesting would be, you know, some sort of, you know, head mounted kit to be able to play board games on. So everyone would just be seeing the same thing. And there's something annoying about standing there holding your phone
exactly.
in front of
you. Right. Like I was thinking, for instance, if I wanted to make an AR-enabled Nerf basketball hoop game, right? Where I have
right.
a ball and my app is, I'm going to hold my phone and there's going to be this virtual hoop
right.
up on the door frame that
right.
isn't really there that I'm shooting towards. It seems incredibly awkward to
yeah.
try to do.
Yeah.
Right? Because I'm holding this thing with my left hand and I'm seeing where the hoop is. And it's
you're
like,
tracking a ball with
yeah,
it.
Yeah. I mean, I just, those sorts of things. As long as we're holding on to the device in our hand,
yeah,
it seems really limited to like the Snapchatty sort of thing of like, oh, I took a yeah. picture and then
there's a Squirtle on my
yeah,
cat's
whatever,
head.
So.
Yay! I guess I agree to a certain extent, but it's a step motion towards, you know, something else, right? Like so, hopefully. All the frameworks, et cetera, and this will eventually get extended to some other platform, right? So it that seems like it's a stepwise move, right?
Uh-huh.
To move through that. And then two, I mean, new medium are confusing to people, and yeah. they're especially confusing to people who are trying to make things in that new medium, which means, you know, you have to the medium is there, and then you spend the next decade or two trying to figure out what
right.
like what you would do with that medium.
So here's an idea. Could I go and start working on something where on my floor, on your floor here, we go and we put down red tape that's going to be like a racetrack. Like
mm-hmm.
we make some crazy, you know, F1 style, you know, racetrack. It's not an oval.
Right.
Right. And we put that down and then our app has our car and we're just looking at the phone the whole time. And driving it, and it has to, you know, the red line is the
yeah.
the detection of, I mean, that seems like
that's
that
an idea.
That's
I
an
think,
idea. I mean,
I think it's a fantastic for, okay, so here's two examples.
That could be kind of fun.
That aren't games. So one is, and I have my Slave One Boba Fett ship that I just put together. Can you imagine like that being your installation, your setup instructions, right? Like, here's the next piece you need to go put on, right?
Mm-hmm.
You just put your camera at whatever the pile of pieces you have, and it's like pick this piece up and put it there, like or you're stuck, right? Or IKEA,
wait, so it's
IKEA
able to like
assembly.
Highlight on the screen
sure,
which is the piece
sure.
you want. I see.
Yeah, 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 and then show you like oh, and this is where it goes
because
right?
of the object detection. Of,
right,
I see.
Right, right.
Yeah.
The space. I mean, I'm so IKEA, right? Like,
sure.
how many people in the world could that help? How much IKEA rage could we save? By letting you point your phone at your broken shelf that you're trying to put together and be like, oh, this is backwards or something, right? Like, it's that isn't, you know, a tomorrow sort of solution that
mm-hmm.
I feel like we're going to have. But those are two things that are probably doable to a certain extent.
I would like to, our bathroom upstairs, I would really like to remodel.
Yeah,
right?
remodeling. Yeah,
so I'd perfect, right? I mean, it's like, okay, this app can understand the space, and now I can go and put in different fixtures and kind of imagine the whole thing in a way that I don't have to learn some of the home design software that,
yeah.
I mean, I know those things do that, right? But it's just...
Or you could change the color of your walls. Like something
yeah,
simple,
that's,
right?
That's,
like,
I can see that being
very yeah, specific. Yeah. Like you just walk in and you pan your camera around and say, mm-hmm. "Oh, what if this was teal?" Right?
Mm-hmm.
And these aren't games, right? Mm-hmm. But they're definitely usable. The difference, though, is that, like you said, like you're not going to play a 2-hour game holding your phone in front of your face.
I mean, the racing
table.
Things, like you, since you're not interacting physically, you could just sort of be racing. And the cool part about that is that you're able to make new tracks just by rearranging where the tape is.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of
right.
That's kind of fun because you could, you know, make little jumps and all sorts of things without
mm-hmm.
special track.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be, I don't know. Sounds like that would be a good time. I mean, I like racing games. So
yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in that space, right? Like there is a certain level of awkwardness that
until
that
the cat comes across the red tape and just
yeah.
poses everything.
Great, your car crashes because the kitty cat just decides
collision
to
detection,
bonk.
Feline collision detection.
Poor Scruffy, everyone's in trouble now. I don't know. I just feel like it has a lot of potential. I mean I haven't played with it, and I don't own a VR headset or anything like that.
My phone, I think ARKit is only on iPhone 6S,
mm-hmm.
so I only have a 6. So
oh.
I can't even use it.
You're not even there.
What do you have?
I think mine's the 7. Right?
Is it?
So it's the 7S.
Okay.
So I think...
I need a new phone if I want to play around with it.
Well, you should wait 4 months.
Well, sure.
And, it's not the time to buy a new iPhone, but... I mean, you can.
It's never the time to buy new.
It's never. It's always old, and the next one's going to be so much better.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm excited about the potential, and I'm excited about kind of this slow addition of these technologies right into these consumer level devices. You know, so and it's not just the AR functionality, right? So now we have the. I was going to say AI. That's not the term. The ML, right? So we have ML, the new worst acronym. But now you can now
you're machine learning.
Yeah. So now you can get some machine learning on from your device. Hopefully, getting
what do you see as an exciting use of that?
Well, this surface detection stuff, right? Like is got to be using some of it. There's got to be something to do with face detection and just anything that's trying to recognize something that's on the camera. It seems like
that's the main thing I've heard is that, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
image recognition
stuff, right?
Yep.
Or surface recognition. But I mean my disappointment with Siri has always been that I wanted to make Infocom style games for the phone, just so you could
talk to it.
So you could talk to it, and you could have the Zork or.
So you want an IF audiobook?
I think it would be hilarious.
Yeah,
and I think it would be interesting in a way. It's like one of the a video game that blind people can play in a weird sort of way.
Yeah,
I don't know. I love that particular genre of games, that second person sequence of games, the text
standing
adventures.
In a field.
You're standing in
there's
a mailbox. And there's a certain place in my heart for that. So when I see things that can be used for that, I'm like, "Oh, that's going to be great."
Uh-huh.
Well,
maybe I can work in some AR ideas into Tales from the Loop, because that would certainly be I'm not sure what device they might have. Certainly the kids wouldn't have one. But,
true.
Maybe we can figure out a way that can work that in there, now that I've, you know, we can mix some of these things together.
Yeah, it's true. I love the IF, and I'm really psyched about AR.
Do you still keep up with new interactive fiction?
I haven't been, not the last 3 or 4 years. I used to play a lot of the games. There's a competition every year.
Right.
IF
yep.
Comp.
Yep.
And I was working on kind of playing with some of the languages.
But do you just enjoy some of them is what I'm asking
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You do.
To play them. Yeah.
But do you play any? Have you played any in the last couple of years?
No.
You haven't?
No, okay. No. It's kind of fallen off my radar a little bit. But
time.
I was. Yeah, it's time. I have too many hobbies. I do too many things, and then but I used to play with the Inform language and try to build build rooms and build environments. I didn't get very far kind of building an entire game.
Mm-hmm.
But that particular Inform 6 and Inform 7. So I started playing with those. Okay, so I'm going to go backwards even further. So when I was a kid, I used to try to build text adventures in BASIC, mm-hmm. and that is the wrong tool for mm-hmm. trying to build a text adventure, especially when you're 7 years old. But I would write, you know, 1,000-line text adventures that only work if you knew exactly what to type in, because, you know, my ability to understand linguistic analysis at 7 years old, not very great.
Mm-hmm.
But then, God, what, 5 or 10 years ago, I got into the Inform language. So the Zork.
Is this the one that's like kind of storyboard based
No. So I know what you're
thinking
talking
of something
about.
Else,
yeah, there's like 7 or 8.
Okay, I'm thinking of this one that's kind of visual.
Yeah, you're thinking of the 4GL, the 4GL, you draw pictures to
okay.
do stuff.
Okay.
So there is some of that in 7, I think. But I was really getting into it with Inform 6, and the thing about Inform is that it'll compile to this. This Z machine thing. So back in the day,
you just said compile and Z machine, and everyone just
I know
turned.
Everyone just turned off.
Everyone just hit stop.
So I'm going to give context. That's not the. So I'll tell you why that's interesting. So back in the day, Infocom was this company that would made just jillions of text adventures, right? So they made Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. They made all the Zorks. They made the cheeseball things like Leather Goddesses of Phobos.
Yep.
They made all these hilarious, you know, text adventure games, and they were really iconic. And they were something that I enjoyed a lot as a kid. And what I learned later is that they developed essentially a virtual machine for those games, and so they would write in this this language that would get run on this VM, and so that let them do what kind of Java and JavaScript kind of does in the browser, right?
Mm-hmm.
So and target all these different platforms. So you'd see all these games come out on the Commodore, on the Apple, and all the piles of platforms there were in the
right, let
the
them go multi-platform 80s. Cheaply.
Yeah,
yes,
and
right.
and which I'm like looking back was pretty impressive for the 80s, right? When everyone's writing assembly and C and compiling on these different platforms. So,
well, and the reason why they were doing that, at least my understanding is, you know, say you want to write for Amiga or something that had better graphics, like you're writing for that so that you can get the right graphics for that. But when you're just writing text, it doesn't matter as much. Like what you're trying to do, you know what I'm saying? You're not.
Yeah.
It's not as tailored. I mean, at the end of the day, all of these platforms are able to emit and accept text. I mean, that's
what
they do.
So what you're saying is there's not a lot of hardware hooks that you need into your virtual machine, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't need to.
Yeah.
There's no OpenGL whatever that you have to, you know, retool to plug into the graphics hardware to make work. Yes.
Right.
But they tried to pivot into business software. So they tried to pivot that technology,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
Into multi-platform business software, which I find really fascinating.
What was their flagship thing they tried?
I don't know. I didn't buy it. I was 10 years old. I wasn't buying business software, but
no, I'm just curious if there was like a
they did not succeed is the point. But you know, a decade or two later, that would have been an amazing and kind of brilliant pivot.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the 80s, it was probably too heavy of a lift, and you know the
computers weren't all over business yet, in the way they are.
They did
in the 90s.
Yeah, they were getting there, right? Like the spreadsheets and word processors.
But in the 90s, like every job that anybody does, that's not like. Is going to involve a computer. I mean, you know, general contractors use a computer, right? It became a part of every job.
Yeah, whereas it was just, that was transitioning in the 80s. So
right.
So they were too early in like multiple dimensions, right?
Yeah.
Right. So it was just, I just find it fascinating that this company that made these games about, mm-hmm. you know, crawling in the underdark or whatever, right? To go find these mysterious things. And in Trinity, you climb into a baby carriage and open an umbrella to move forward. Like these just really silly puzzle games had this really thoughtful plan to
well, and today you couldn't even make a dime making that type of a game. I mean, you couldn't make anything.
You'd have to have ad traffic. You'd have to have a flashing.
Right, but back then everything went into a cardboard rectangular box.
Oh, that's the worst. So it's one of the things I think about a lot. Like, if I'd been born like a decade earlier and started making those, because you could make and sell that style of game as a 20-year-old and make a living, right? And at those and sell them for I don't know
what they would have went for.
Not a dollar, like App Store prices.
$20.
Yeah, like cardboard box prices, and enough that you could make like color maps and all these cute little things that came along with those games, right? Like there was work done.
Yeah, so not a text game, but to this day, so one of my favorite games on the Commodore was Sid Meier's Pirates.
Yeah,
did you ever play that?
No.
Do you know what you're a pirate, and it's a sandbox game. It's one of the first sort of graphical sandbox games I remember. Where it's like, you know, you just have your ship and you can get more ships. You can work for one of the four governments. You can just be an out and out pirate, and you're a pirate in the Caribbean. And you know, you have little mini games where you're trying to court governor's daughters, et cetera, right? And I played, you know, and it was great because you would have your whole career. And at some point it got too hard and, you know, you had too much competition. Your crew was unruly. You had to retire. And then they would tell you, did you retire as like, you know, you had like a whole scale of like from
the
top.
Sid Meier.
You know, exactly. So of you know, were you a beggar or were you, did you end up as a plantation owner or were you a courtier or whatever? But what I was going to say was that game with the box, right, in addition to just being great, came with this awesome map, like sort of authentic, you know, looking map of the Caribbean.
Right.
And it had all of the places, the locations marked like from 1660, right? So my understanding of the Caribbean for a kid in Chicago was incredible. Like I know where all these places were, and you know, some of the places aren't even places anymore because they changed their names or this or that. But I have a very good sense of Caribbean geography because of that, because of the map that came in Sid Meier's Pirates game.
But that's pretty much not a thing. Either you're a billion-dollar producer now. Right. Mm-hmm. Or I guess there are mid-sized games. There's just, it feels like there's not very many of them. Maybe we're being crazy. But so they had a VM in the freaking 80s. Right.
Yeah.
And this language, this inform language. And I think they wrote essentially in that VM's assembly back then. But there was this language that was, I believe, reverse engineered. So someone reverse engineered the VM and built an actual programming language for writing games on top of that VM. And so I started learning that language, and then 7 came out, and so Inform 7 did kind of what you were describing, a little 4GL. So 4GL, maybe this isn't even a term anymore, is where you're programming by drawing pictures, right? So there's a little bit of that in Inform 7, but most of it is natural language programming. So it's a little entertaining in the sense that you write a sentence. There is a room with a birdcage in it, right?
Okay.
And it is south of this room, right? And so you write in natural language. And
it's able to parse that and pull it into options of what you can do and things to interact with.
So I suspect, right? Like it translates that, and it's not perfect natural language, right? Like it's a little, it's going to be a little stilted, but it takes that natural language. And I think it builds that down to like Inform 6 and then builds it into the actual, kind of pseudo assembly that's run on that VM. But I was fascinated by this, and I was playing with both Inform 6 and then Inform 7, which came out when I was spent a lot of time learning in Form 6. but yeah, I haven't been playing the games. Mm-hmm. There's so many good ones, and there are a number of good books on that.
There's several good iOS apps that kind of take it a step further, just adding a little bit of graphical mm-hmm. flair, mm-hmm. you know, for like Steve Jackson's sorcery mm-hmm. series mm-hmm. Is probably one of the bigger examples. But there's several others as well, that like Dead Men Tell No Tales, I think is like a pirate theme. Have you heard of that one?
No, but
okay.
I, you know,
there's these sorts of things where, you know, they have their niche and if they're well done, I mean, they end up doing quite well for games that have mostly no graphics that you're in. They might have some graphics in the way that a book is illustrated.
Right.
But that's kind of the extent of it.
Yeah. You're not navigating space and that's
right.
Like I said, I have a special place in my heart for that genre of mm-hmm. games. IF Comp is pretty cool. They have that event every year. So if you're into it, you should check it out.
But, well, that's a question I should have asked Girish Patel.
Which
games he was playing?
That would have been,
I got to ask him. Yeah.
I hope he can answer. It seems like he should have a good answer.
Yeah. We'll try to get some more everyday life scenes in between the next.
Is it 87?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you'd have...
You have quite a bit. I mean, you certainly could have played all the Infocom stuff.
Oh,
for sure. Like 82, 3.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and then lots of...
What would have been cutting edge in 87? Like, what would have been...
Oh, I don't know. I would have to look it up. I don't have that... But I would have been...
I mean, that would have been a... Pirates, I think, was
like... when the GS came out? 87?
Sure. I mean, it also could have just been Nintendo. But, I mean, if he was more of a... If that kid, that character is more of a hardcore geek, he's probably more...
He's probably, I still think he's a BBS kid. Okay. I think if you're a super nerd in that period of time, you're probably on the BBSs, you know, doing.
So some early MUDs.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Right. I mean, that would be the time for that.
Yeah. No, I guess we'll find out next time when we figure out which games.
Cause those were really big by like 90, 91, 92.
Yeah.
They were.
Yeah.
You know,
what was the outcome of all those, you know, dial-in BBSs, all those terminal systems, right? And then also all the Unix boxes everyone's SSHing into everywhere.
That would be an interesting That would be an interesting documentary, if it hasn't been done, or doc book or something like that.
The MUDs.
Well, of the people that made them.
Right.
The people that made them possible, right? Because if you think about it, the reasons why those were so interesting... I wasn't really into that stuff at that time, but the reason why I gather it was so interesting is it wasn't the static thing. It was like, oh, I can go and create my own room and have my own stuff in it. And so you're building onto the virtual world as opposed to interacting with something that someone else created.
Yeah, well, it's multi-user, right? Which
but it's not just the multi-user. It's the multi-user in that all the people can build it together, as opposed to everyone walking through somebody else's castle.
Right.
You get to build your own addition.
Right.
That to me, I think that's the interesting part. Not the other users is certainly cool, but that would have come no matter what. The part that I would be interested in a documentary or something is the guys that created the programs that allowed people to build on and have that all be saved. That'd be pretty interesting. Like how they...
There has to be one.
The evolution of
there
it.
There has to be one.
Oh, I'm sure there's some ebook out there.
Oh no, I'm sure there's two there's a dozen ebooks. I mean, I'm like, there I can't believe there's not a documentary of that stuff. That's so crazy. That time was, oh god, we had
I'd like to learn more about it, because I wasn't like immersed in that. You know, I was way more into just real life things at that
point.
I mean, I liked video games, but more in a way that, you know, just a kid would enjoy a video game. I wasn't like a aficionado or anything like that.
Yeah, and I wasn't too into. I did some BBSing stuff in the 80s, but not like a crazy, not like our characters.
Well, I mean, you had to have a modem, right? You had to even know that a modem was a thing.
Oh, we had one
to begin with. I didn't have one till college, so.
Oh, we had one. We acquired lots of games through that. 400 baud or whatever.
Yeah.
Really, really slowly. But yeah, I just didn't get too into the social aspect of those worlds. But looking back, that's probably one of the most interesting things about them. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, predating that, I mean, I didn't have a Commodore 64, which probably you could have bought a modem for, but we would just have my friend's dad knew someone who just would give us a catalog of games to pirate, right? So you would order, I think I told you this before, you would just mark down the games you want, and then he would tell you how many floppies that was going to be, and it was $5 a floppy. And then you just get your pirated floppies, and
oh my god,
and you just stick those in your Commodore disk drive, and that's how you play games.
Yeah, that was so crazy. It was such a crazy time. Like, we used to have, it was probably a 4 or 6 row. We had a case. Like, my dad had made this case, this wooden case for floppies. And there's probably 4 or 6 rows of the things. And there's probably, you know, like 100 in each row.
We're talking about the big floppies.
The 5 and a quarter. Not the 3
not the
and
non-floppy
a half.
Floppies.
No, not the rigid floppy disks. No. the ones that were, now I used to know the K on each one of those. What was 100? No, I don't remember.
Oh, the original ones were 1.44 meg.
No,
yeah, they were.
No, they were like 720K.
I don't know, double sided, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Oh, maybe. Oh my god, megs.
we've went hardcore geek on
I know,
this episode.
This has gotten worse. I was trying to rein us in. Trying to rein us in for a minute there, and I failed.
Well, hey, we successfully swerved away from politics, so I mean,
that's what we should do next, just to ruin everything.
Well, I can barely feel like I can have an informed conversation because I was in Canada for 11 days. Where,
oh, you're not up on what has been happening.
Well, a little bit, but not.
I can tell you, I'm not up on what has been.
So, happening. Not like I was. So. The only real interaction I had foisted upon me while in Canada was we were at one breakfast buffet at a hotel, and it was like no matter where you sat, there was a television with Sunday morning news on, right? And it was interesting that it was in Canada, and it's like, let's watch the U.S. political Sunday morning news shows. Like, I'm not sure whose decision that was, or but I think it was maybe because they got Spokane, Washington network or something. I'm not entirely sure why that was the case.
Right.
But during breakfast, that was pretty much unavoidable,
mm-hmm.
at that breakfast buffet thing. But other than that, any news I would have gotten, would have been me seeking it out, like me just sort of checking something, because we didn't really turn on the TV a whole lot. And when we did, it was tended to just be Canada Day preparations or celebrations or whatever. And I was like, oh, this is great. You know, I don't have to do that. And then since getting back, I haven't been as tuned into things on the politics side. I mean, I like vaguely, but I'm just trying to do this slow thing in every way possible of, you know, not divorcing myself from what I feel about that, because it just seems all bad. So,
did you listen to any of the podcasts that we talked about?
I listened to a little bit. So that's the other thing. I've hardly listened to any podcasts.
That's good.
I listened to probably the one that you talked about with the Freakonomics with Coke on there. I listened to maybe like 20 minutes of it while everyone was at the coming back from the I'd come back from the pool early. And when we were in Calgary, and I listened to a little bit of that, and I wasn't going to make everyone listen to that while I'm in the car.
And
I was also just sort of like generally getting enraged, like dealing with that while I was gone. So I was like, I'm not going to do this. Like, I don't need to do this.
I think we should, I'm actually interested in that. I think we should save that one for later, because I think it's, this is your tired face. Your tired face is on right now. I think it's interesting. And you do occasionally listen to the Fifth Column podcast, which is one of the crazy libertarianish ones that I listen to. And they I'll probably edit this out because it's not interesting. But so
as opposed to everything else we talked about.
There's a book that I don't read it. I should get a physical copy, but I listen to an Audible every year or two. And it's Christopher Hitchens. Hitchens.
Sure.
So he wrote have you read Letter to a Young Contrarian?
I don't think I have.
Okay. So it's one of my I love Hitchens. I don't think anyone always agrees with Hitchens. And I don't even know how much I agree with Hitchens, but I used to love listening to him. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that book specifically I really enjoyed. And so I just downloaded it on Audible, and then they start talking about, oh yeah, I just reread this. It's so great. I was like, this is so terrible. This is why I listen to this stuff, because they agree with me too much. but yeah, it was fun. They're talking about that book right after I just downloaded it to listen to it again.
So the thing I think we could talk about safely.
Oh no.
Well, no, is without necessarily getting to the meat of it is. While we were having this exchange around Coke and this whole other thing, I don't know, there was somebody, you sent me something of so-and-so wanted so-and-so to apologize. But without getting into without getting into all that, what I think I realized, and maybe I'm wrong, but is that you are interested in the actual academic part of the arguments of what people are talking about, and the part that makes me angry is the effects.
So
it's like the physical manifestations of like I don't really care what professor argued with what professor, or this or that, or name called, or the other thing, because winning that type of like academic philosophical argument to me is meaningless when the effects are just lots of money pouring into effects that I don't think are positive. So I feel like our focus in terms of what we're paying attention to is like, we're looking at the same picture, but it's like, you're looking at the left side of the picture and I'm looking at this other part of the picture.
Oh yeah.
Well, I don't mean left, right, political. I just mean like two different sections of the same.
It's the elephant metaphor, right? Like a bunch of blind guys grab an elephant, right. And they're grabbing a different part and they describe it totally differently. Right. So I think that's true to an extent. I think,
is my assessment, like, is it in the, would you say that you are more lean towards that stuff and I'm more,
I think I understand why you say that. Because I think I would disagree with kind of the way that you're putting it, right? So it implies that I don't care about results.
Saying that I care about that when I focus on these arguments, that I'm focusing on them more.
So, and I think that's a really common perspective on this sort of thing. I guess the point that I was trying to make by sending that to you,
mm-hmm.
and keeping in mind that I don't know anything about the Koch brothers. I know very little about them. I care very little about them. But the point that I was trying to make was that you seem to have really embraced a lot of this criticism of them in particular, and a lot of the kind of ideological stuff around them, right? Especially having read that
I didn't
that,
finish that book. I haven't.
Because you couldn't? Because you're like, oh,
no,
so tired.
Because
so
I'm part
negative.
Of a book club and I have to go read other things is why.
So the point I was trying to make is that I don't, there's an extent to which I have no dog in their particular fight, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're right in that I am an idealist, mm-hmm. right? And so that I occasionally operate in those worlds of conceptual stuff. But this woman, right, wrote this book.
Which I didn't
about
read.
This guy. I know, that's not the point. The point is that she is intellectually dishonest, right? And I know, and you don't care. That's what I think is hilarious. But the evidence that you're using, right, Just he's making shape. He's making faces at me. I'm such a oh no. The evidence that you're using to come to the conclusion that these are bad people are being put forth by people with a definite ideological axe to grind and are being intellectually dishonest, at least in this particular example, right? And so what where I was going, right, is that I don't know how it seems hard to come to like real conclusions that X, Y, and Z has a bad result for whatever reason, right? Because you're building this logical scaffolding on something that isn't necessarily propagandistic in a certain way, right? Like I get really uncomfortable with arguments that are tribalistic in dishonest ways, right? So it says these guys are bad because of this thing that they did, and it turns out they didn't do this thing, and it's just a made up story in a certain way. And so,
well, it's not made up that they've created so why do I dislike them? I dislike them because they're good at what they do, right? If they were incompetent, I would give a shit, okay? But they're really good at what they do.
So your perceived results, there are results that you don't like that you think are their objectives, and you think they're being successful in their objectives.
Anyone who's creating the financial backing for policies of people such as Betsy DeVos in education is a travesty, okay?
Fair enough.
I mean, like, if that's your vision of America, then in terms of like results and the results that the outcomes that they want,
right?
I disagree. So I this is why I brought up. Have you read Nation Colony in a Nation yesterday?
Right. I read his other book.
Okay, by Chris Hayes.
Yeah.
Because that book, I mean, you may certainly disagree about.
I think I sent you the discussion with him, and he was on Ezra Klein, right?
No, I watch a show on MSNBC. I mean, he's a liberal pundit guy. I mean, he's smart, and I like Chris Hayes a lot. I like you know, Chris Hayes, Ezra Klein. I mean, those sorts of guys are the sort of people that I like to listen to.
Yeah,
Hayes is more.
I listen to Klein's show. I'm like 80% happy when he's talking most of the time.
All right, but the reason I sent you that was you haven't read it, but I find this book just, you know, fascinating, as well written, et cetera. You know, it's about tying there's two criminal justice systems, not just one criminal justice system with racial discrimination, but there's two, and he's tying this back historically all the way back to the American being a colony of Britain, right? And, and that's part of his thesis of what he's talking about. This book, so there's certain things about libertarianism versus liberalism that I think we would very much disagree on. This is an area where I feel there's overlap, right? We may disagree on some of the causes and some of the ways that you go about it, but I think we would both agree that the status quo is, you know, is not good.
It's pretty bad.
It's pretty bad, right? Yeah.
So we would disagree on how we got here, and we would disagree on the solution to get out of the situation. That's what you're saying. But we would probably agree.
I'm just saying that the outcome, I think we would be closer on than we might be on the outcome for healthcare.
Yeah, maybe. I could see that.
Right. I'm just saying, I think that there's certain areas where we can, you know, there's like common goals or whatever. But, and I think, you know, I don't know what I find bizarre around the far right and you know, the money that's powering a lot of these things is that, you know, there's all this like far right libertarian, you know, Koch brothers, the whole.
I would take umbrage with the dimensionality of your statement, but sure.
But I would say that it is that because of the outcomes of what happens. So they try to present themselves as, you know, oh, we're for either side, but in reality, they are just powering the GOP establishment agenda is what's happening.
You think that's the result?
I think that's the result.
Yeah.
Right.
And
so while he can talk a game about like, oh, I started up because of George W. Bush and the biggest government, blah, 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 blah. They just keep powering the same. It's not like they're actually like saying, oh, we don't have a horse in the game and this is the outcomes we want. That's bullshit. I mean, they have a horse in the game. It's the GOP establishment, and that's what they're powering.
Okay. So basically what you're saying is they're intellectually dishonest in anything they say. You won't give any credence to their intentions, right? Because you don't believe their stated intentions. You think the results that they're getting are the result of their real intentions. So you think they're happy with the Trump presidency, for example? You think that they think this is great? This is exactly all the things.
Sure,
they
because
want?
He has no ideology. If one thing is 100% true,
yeah,
Trump has zero.
He's a goldfish.
He's a goldfish. He has no ideology. He will go along with whatever winning means today.
Yeah, well, he's playing kind of goldfish or monkey dominance games constantly, and he's not.
Yeah,
there is no. Yeah,
right. So I mean, if they could come to him and be like, "Look, we got all the senators, we got all the House guys we need to get a thing for you to look good," he'd go along with. Yeah. I'm pretty sure anything.
I mean, yeah. What?
So the other part, and this
such
is
such a train wreck. But I.
But the other part where I think you could argue is it propaganda, etc., is how much influence. That money and that whole foundation that you have to have $100,000 to commit annually, you know, et cetera, is doing damage in terms of gerrymandering and having voters be excluded, that sort of stuff, like things that I would call anti-democratic. And so you take issue with that. And I'm not going to sit here and like put forth a case. I can't like prove that, but it's certainly not.
What do I take issue with?
You took issue that I called somebody anti-democratic that I never did. You like Tyler Cowen or something. Like I never said he was.
I didn't mean to say you said that he was, but the article that I was sending you said that like Tyler Cowen hates democracy. And...
But I don't care about the Economists. Like they don't matter because all they are is they are just sort of like academic cover for people to go
right.
and get outcomes. That's all it is to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just cover. Right. I mean, that's fine. I mean, like they can like power each other that like, you know, the economists can get grants from industrialists and the industrialists can use the economists for.
Do you think that
cover.
Flows in both directions? Do you think the left wing economists are both just intellectual cover for powerful people in the left leaning?
I don't think about it. I don't think about it because they're always losing.
The left leaning economists are always losing.
Dude, we have
Keynesians
again. How many scientists do we have out there around climate change? But
we're talking about economists, not scientists.
No, but I'm just saying, you could argue the right would argue that all of these scientists are left leaning. I mean, how in the world could you have this many scientists and it's like, oh, we're gonna, you know, pull out of these things because it's bad for America?
I really want you to listen to the rest of those interviews because I think it'd be
with Coke.
Yeah, yeah. Because I know.
So it's gonna hurt you.
You
gave me a ha when I said it was just him doing his own personal PR. Is it not him doing his own personal PR?
I think when you're like a 80 or 90 year old billionaire,
gajillionaire. No, he's an 80.
Who owns the company that owns Lycra and like all these other things,
yeah.
right? Like, the fact that you think he has to bullshit people about his ideology on a random small podcast, I think it's baffling. I think so.
Why is he there? Why does he have to do anything?
He doesn't have to do anything. So,
oh, I'm not saying he's lying. I'm not saying he's bullshitting. I'm saying he's there to do PR. That's not bullshitting.
Okay. So I thought you were implying that he's being dishonest.
No.
No.
He believes everything he says.
Oh. Okay.
No. I don't think he's dishonest.
So you just think that the results that we have now are. They're the results of their ideals.
If they could, if he could fill the entire Supreme Court with eight other clones of Neil Gorsuch, he would.
Right.
I find that appalling. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what else you want me to say.
It's fine. It's fine. I'm just curious. I'm curious. I think nothing's gonna happen when you listen to the rest of it now. But I think it's interesting. Yeah, listen to them talk about climate change and that sort of thing.
I'm interested to hear that. I mean, the climate change is the one thing that I just don't even get.
That's why I want you to listen to that conversation and because I want to see your reaction. There are two things, and now I don't remember.
So is he going to be, you know, is he going to have? Just tell me, does he have a position that you think I would agree with personally? And if so, why is all of his money powering the opposite?
So. He has a position. I'm not sure that it's what you would agree with personally. So, and now I'm thinking back to a podcast I listened to like 3 weeks ago, but what I remember him saying is like, yeah, sure. That's a thing, but we keep passing these laws that do nothing, but they do nothing to change to remedy the problem, but they hurt business. And so he's going to be against those sorts of laws, right? So there's a lot of, so I could talk about it from my perspective, right? And my perspective is a lot of what we do for things that help the earth, right? A lot of it is the modern secular equivalent of going to church and doing these things that are outward visible signs to other people in the community that you're virtuous, right? So it's virtue signaling, and maybe, and often 100%.
Okay, but I'm gonna stop you right there.
Yeah.
I'm gonna stop you right there. And that's fine. Like, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of that going on. Okay, totally. But how does it help to have people in leadership around environment issues that deny the science?
I'm not defending that. I think politics is messy as hell.
It's
right?
The same thing with healthcare. It's like there's so much dishonesty from all sides of what they want to do because they have to keep playing this brinksmanship of they can't give an inch. I mean, it's the same thing with guns, with everything.
Do you want me to acknowledge that American politics is seriously broken right now? Because
no,
I will do that.
No, it is. It is unbelievably broken, right?
Yeah.
We totally agree on that. But with climate change, it's like, can't everybody just agree on the science and then, you know, debate different sides of the solutions rather than, no, we're going to take such a hardline thing here. This happens on every issue. They're going to take this hardline issue that is nonsensical. With healthcare, this isn't even about, none of the things that are being floated out there have anything to do with reducing costs of care.
No, they're asinine.
None of them, yeah. Right? It's all about playing games with insurance companies and like what insurance companies can do. None of the things actually get at reducing any type of costs. So they're just like shuffling deck chairs type of thing, right?
What they're trying to do is they're trying to look like they're doing something, right? Like they, at the end of the day, they're trying to look like they're doing something, and they're trying to make money off of it, and they're trying to help their friends make money off
of it. But what needs to happen is on all of these different issues is that everyone can at least agree on like some basic facts, but they won't even do, like, I can understand having an argument and saying like, okay, well, we disagree about, you know, the cause of this or the solution or whatever. Like, that's fine. But this whole having your own set of facts thing around climate and around healthcare costs, that's the thing that is insane to me that I don't understand. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm the victim of propaganda, but I tend to feel that the right makes more ridiculous arguments. When a senator goes into the Senate holding a snowball and says, look, there's no climate change, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. And how much of that? Yeah. I guess I don't I don't disagree about that. So there's this thing that happens, what was it? Freud called it the narcissism of minor differences, right? Where when, you know, two ideologies or know, religious organizations are too close together, they really hate each other the most, right? And so
Sunni and Shia, is that the
yeah,
is
well,
that an example of that? I don't know.
I was more thinking just like the history of the various Christian religions, okay, right, in Europe, where they would burn people at the stake for not being Trinitarians or something, right? Like, you know, like there's all these other religious groups that you could murder that are further away and that are so different and alien, but you don't murder them because it's inconvenient to go murder them
star-bellied sneeches.
Yeah. And but it's a star-bellied sneech sort of thing. And it's one of the things I think, I find interesting about the liberal libertarian kind of dichotomy, right? Like this kind of eternal combat between the two, in the sense that I think conceptually there's so much agreement on so many things, but the characterization, right, from both sides is so radically different, right? So the left constantly describes the libertarians as extreme right wing, right? Which, I mean, I don't know how you characterize an ideology that wants to get rid of the drug war as extreme right wing, for example. Like it's not part of the historical right-wing ideology. Not that there is a right-wing ideology anymore, I think, but and I think the libertarians struggle with the some of the craziness and on the left of just the over-characterizing some of the aspects of that as you know, almost communist in ways, right? Mm-hmm. And I just think it's unhelpful to the dialogue a lot of the time to focus on some of the extremes, right? So like you could focus on what's the university.
I would just say that. So maybe my mischaracterization, of libertarianism would be, you can tell me if it's a mischaracterization, that libertarians believe that there should, that like a social safety net is unwarranted.
I think that's really rare to encounter. Mm-hmm. And so if you go read the
Wikipedia, because my believing that there should be a social safety net does not make me, I'm not a communist. Like that's so far from that.
I know, but I'm
so far from that.
I'm giving an example of the two kind of tensions, right? And the two ways, the two sides that agree on a lot of things just demonize each other constantly. And so I think if you go listen to Tyler Cowen or you go listen to the Econ Talk podcast, which I've listened to for like a decade, and listen to Russ Roberts. Like, I don't think you're going to hear that we should have zero safety net. That's not a thing that you're going to hear. Now, if you go read the Wikipedia definition of libertarian, or you go to a meetup with a bunch of people, it's to a certain extent, it's not the common ideology, right? Like it's not Republican or Democrat, and therefore it's a smaller organization, and you're going to get more fringy people in a smaller group, right? They're going to be
There's still a core belief that poor people are poor because they do bad things.
I don't think that's true.
Okay. But that's the characterization.
Yeah.
That'll be my characterization, right, of a libertarian.
Yeah, so,
is that they are the sort of person who says poor people are poor because they do bad things.
Usually they use the word social Darwinism to demonize the libertarians,
but,
too.
But
like,
I'm just trying
like
to put it in simple first grade words.
Yeah, and I think that's a common criticism. And I'm sure, just like I've met people on the left that believe that everyone should have the same salary.
That's insane. I mean, that's...
There you go. So what I'm trying to say is, though, the people that say that poor people are poor because they're, you know, inferior or something, right?
No, I said because they do bad things, because of the vices they have.
Sure.
That's my characterization.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think people that are that oversimplifying of the world are kind of mentally the same kind of people that think everyone should have the same salary, right? Like they're just like radically oversimplifying the world in unhelpful ways. And I think,
but isn't that the like evangelical Protestant tradition? I mean, isn't that the like, I didn't grow up in that, right? I mean, I grew up in a Catholic tradition, which is different.
Yeah. The Calvinist sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think so. I think so.
Okay. I mean,
I don't know. Trying to go somewhere. I don't know where you're trying to go, but I would say I don't think that most libertarians that you would encounter would have that as a piece of their belief system. I think they would kind of flip it in the sense that
so the reason I go there is because if I could boil down almost every disagreement I would have with someone opposite politically,
right,
it's going to come down to that nugget of that belief, as opposed to poor people are poor because in a lot of cases the system fucks them and it's structurally rigged.
Yeah.
Right.
And
I think I'm really fortunate to not be poor myself. Right. And it's like, I don't believe that like I'm successful in my whatever definition of success because of like, oh, because I'm a virtuous person or something. It's like, I'm successful because the system is structured to bias towards me.
So I would agree with you to a certain extent. And then I would say you're making kind of the opposite oversimplification thing, right? Like you're not successful solely because of that.
No, but
right?
I have biases that help me be successful.
Yeah. Yeah. So the system, you mean, has biases,
yes,
right? That helps you be successful. Yes. So the whole, you're a white guy, you weren't born in, you know,
I don't have to worry about the cops.
Southern Louisiana.
You know,
your parents weren't like insanely poor.
Right.
Right. So that's all true. But you're also, you're a reasonably virtuous person, right? Like,
thank you.
I mean, in that Protestant, you know, work ethic sense,
yeah,
right? Like,
sure,
you do your job and you're, you know, compassionate to the people that you work with, and that you, so you're, I think
I'm not self-destructive.
You're not self-destruct, except for your video game, your board game problems.
Oh, come on.
Your your house is a flammable death trap of cardboard. No, not really. That's a joke. I think I'm sure there are people that believe that. And I'm sure there are quotes that you could cherry pick that would give you that.
Let's just take that crystallized way that I'm structuring those sentences out of it for a second. And I'm talking, and I'm just saying, like, because of course, you know, whatever, those that ends up being the fringe. I'm just talking about if your inclination is to like sort of the needle is on one side or the other of that, I think colors a lot of how you view things and what you
needles on one side or the other.
The needle of like of you know why you believe people succeed or you know what you believe about the biases of society, etc. Like, I think that colors what you like colors what you think about healthcare, for instance, right?
So I think again, like, you could find people that would say that, I'm sure, but I think that perspective is more about, or the more common perspective, or the perspective that I think I resonate more with is a lot of the opposite in that sort of way, right? Like, if you listen to you know, Russ Roberts on his podcast talk about injustice or talk about you know, economic policy, he's not trying to punish the poor for being unvirtuous, right? He's concerned, right, about you know, things like regulatory capture that let the powerful make that system injure the poor, right? And so I really think to a certain extent it is the narcissism of minor differences, right? Because The people tend to look at the policy definition, right? So going back to what we talked about earlier, where
people don't look at the policy definition, they look at the messaging.
Sure.
Right.
But so the policy definition that we were talking about before was, we're talking about climate change, and we're talking about dudes saying that, sure, it's a thing, but a lot of the policies that people are putting forth aren't going to fix the problem, and they're going to make the world worse. Right. And so the policy that they're going to put forth is no on this, you know, vote against this set of bills or this set of policies. Right. And the narrative that the people that support those kind of pro, you know, climate protection policies that ostensibly had no effect, right, to improve the climate, they're going to say, well, these people they don't believe in climate change and they're against that sort of thing, right? So the PR that gets put on top of those policy positions from both sides, right, are going to be like you described. They're going to be this kind of black and white, kind of pointless sort of thing, right? But I don't think that the motivations are what you describe, and I don't think even that the policies a lot of the time are what you describe. And I just think it's interesting because it's such a perspective shift. So there's a book, and I'm
not even sure what I describe. Like you're
what my characterization what, of your characterization of what of I
yeah I'm not even sure what that is anymore. So
we're just going down a rabbit hole. There's a book that I will look up and add to my copious show notes. And it's I've got it somewhere, and it's on how different political alignments see different see policy, and so I think there may be four, but I think there are three. I think it's libertarian, liberal, and conservative, or left and right, or whatever. I hate this. I just hate our terminology. It's so nonsensical anymore. But conservative. He describes as seeing everything as a war between not culture, barbarism and what's the opposite of barbarism?
Order.
Yeah, order, right? And that on the left, things tend to be seen as from a perspective of oppressor versus oppressed, mm-hmm. and from the libertarian versus, you know, freedom versus, you know, unfreedom or my...
I have such a problem, and this is the messaging. I have such a problem with the messaging because this is where, in my opinion, the right has just done such a better job. I mean, of messaging with, like, just think about it, right to work, right? Right. It's like they've.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Have you seen that documentary of the guy with the?
No.
I haven't seen it either, but I've heard tell of the guy who's whipping out these.
Oh my god! I mean,
terminology. So it's only so you're implying that it's Orwellian, basically, right?
That it's a misuse of language. Yeah, if that's what you mean by Orwellian.
Well, it's using
a right to work, really. I mean.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That is misleading.
So you think it's misleading.
It is,
right?
Misleading.
So I was talking to my...
Because the opposite of right to work is no right to work.
Yeah.
That's not...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was talking to my friend in Brazil a couple weeks ago. Did we talk about this before? And she was talking about how she's changing jobs, and she had to ask permission of her current employer to go get another job, and had to have like a multi-month lead time and that sort of thing.
Yeah, India's like that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we did talk about this. And so I thought that was interesting. And then I'm constantly deleting responses to tweets that I make. So there was a retweet forget who it was, but it wasn't Ezra Klein, but it was someone along those lines talking about, oh, people want more startups in France. That's just what we need, is a bunch of douchey people doing, you know, selling people things they don't need. And so I went and I got the French unemployment rate and the French youth unemployment rate, which was like,
it's bad.
It's like 25 and 60%. Right. And I tweeted that and responded like, yeah, cause what you want just anyway. So, I mean, I don't have any deep thoughts right now about the right to work or
no, I'm just saying, but on almost every issue, except for the climate change ones, I feel like the right is standing on sort of this bizarre teetering log. I don't really quite understand that, but everything else, like with healthcare, this totally dishonest thing of like patient-centered care, that is such fucking bullshit to describe what they are doing as patient-centered care. Like, oh, we want to not get in between the patient and their doctor. It's like what you are doing. Like, that's great. I think that's a good thing. That's absolutely a virtuous thing, but it has zero to do with your policy. Zero.
If that was the result of the policy, you would support it. That's what you're saying.
Well, sure, but it has nothing to do with the policy.
I mean, it's
unless you mean the patient doesn't have a doctor, then I guess they're getting closer. Then it's patient-centered care. They're putting band-aids on themselves. That's patient-centered care. That's what it is.
Self-treating.
Because that's really what they're thinking, you know?
I mean, there's a big... So having these Orwellian names for bills and things is very... It's very DC, right?
Like, yeah.
It's very DC.
Yes.
And I'm not going to defend the current Republican...
Good.
But I do think that some of the people in policy do have those goals, right? And is that what comes out? It sure doesn't seem like it, right? Like,
no,
real patient-centered care.
Because like it is with software products, it's all about the marketing.
To a certain extent.
Right?
Single payer is going to, right? Like, single payer sounds great. You don't think single payer is a marketing term?
If there is a single payer, then it is actually the policy outcome. I mean, it's at least truth in advertising.
It's at least accurate.
It's at least accurate. Patient-centered care is not accurate.
So, yeah. So now we're going to be...
So.
Oh, God. We're going to talk about death panels soon. It's going to get so bad. I don't know, man. I think it's...
Well, at least we got some of this out of our system.
I know. We can cut things out and it'll be great. I do think it's interesting. I'm definitely not happy with the way the policy world has gone.
So next time I want to talk about this bill that was just proposed.
Single payer.
No. It will go nowhere, but a bill proposed that would introduce multiple, what's it called? Where you have multiple reps per district and things to fight gerrymandering. Multiple reps per district and ranked choice voting.
Oh, ranked choice voting, yeah.
I'd be interested to talk a little bit about ranked choice voting and I forget the official term for it, but basically where when there's enough people, rather than trying to segment the people, you just say, okay, well, this entire metro area gets, you know, six reps or whatever it should be, rather than trying to segment up the metro area. And
divide it by the percentage of the
result. We do ranked choice voting, right? Ranked choice voting, they go together.
Yeah.
So then the top six vote getters and everybody has their rank. And so that way, whatever, we can talk about it more next time, but I think just what those things are and why that has no chance, but I think it would be useful.
Yeah, I'm not super interested in the game theory aspects of fixing our election system, but I will grant you that it's pretty broken in terms of in terms of that. So, all right, so we have a plan for next time. When are we going to play the game again? Next month?
Yeah, probably next month.
So it'll be a while until we have an update about where our kids are and how much progress they've made in defeating the monstrous flapping hordes.
Yeah. And what's behind it all?
What's behind it
dun,
all?
Dun, dun.
What the mystery is. All right. Well, thanks, man.
All right. Yeah, thanks. Morning podcast.
Bum, bum, bum. Context Free is a contrarian content production. Find out more information at contextfree.fm along with our show notes. Our theme music is Chocolate and Cocaine by Lorenzo's Music. Find out more about Lorenzo's Music at lorenzosmusic.com.